Hello, rheumatology podcast listeners. This is Saoirse here from the Motherhood Journal. We are delighted to sponsor this episode of the Rheumatology Physiotherapy podcast. The Motherhood Journal is designed by two new mums for all new mums. We have designed the only journal made for year one of motherhood. It is a gratitude journal, a mum life planner, and a baby memoir all in one book. This beautiful journal will guide you, encourage you, and uplift you, bring you joy, and empower you to trust your instincts, and most importantly, look back on your journey as a new mum with pride. Between these pages is the story of you and your baby, and how you grew together. We wanted to give you guys a special podcast discount code. So just type in POD15, that's POD15 at the checkout for an exclusive discount. All you need to do is head to themotherhoodjournal.com, add a journal to the basket, pop in the discount code, and you will be well on your way to recording the most special moments you will ever get. Check us out now at themotherhoodjournal.com.
Hello, welcome back to Roommates, and I'm delighted to be back interviewing again, which I haven't done very much of recently, for various reasons. But venturing away from the normal topics of conversation, although still remaining in the realms of rheumatology, for this interview with Faye Stones, who is a really interesting combination as a character, really. So not only does she have ankylosing spondylitis, but is also head of MSK services as a physiotherapist, so can give some really good insights into various aspects of being diagnosed with this condition and then her journey with that. We center quite a lot around the symptoms that she has had and how she's managed them, but also how being a physiotherapist has affected her journey as well, which is really, really interesting. And then we also go on to talk about how it affected her with regards to pregnancy, and we try to come to some conclusions around what advice could be given to other ladies who are either thinking of becoming pregnant or are pregnant or about to give birth, who also have inflammatory disorders. So hope this is useful on many different levels, and certainly we branch into the sort of pelvic health, female health sphere here with our inflammatory hats on. Please do get back to me with any thoughts, information, patients that you might have seen who have been on similar journeys, and I'd be really happy to hear that. You can find me, of course, on social media, The Rheumatology Physio, or you can email me jack.march@choosehealth.co.uk. Finally, I'm going to shill a little bit for ratings, reviews. Whatever you can do on your podcast platform would be absolutely brilliant. And don't forget to follow, of course. Lots more rheumatology content to come. I'm going to put a real dedicated period of time into trying to create some content for you all, and really look forward to doing that and hopefully hearing from you all as well as we progress through time. So enjoy this. Tons to learn, lots of things for me to take away, lots of reading for me to go and do as well. So hopefully you will find it as interesting as I did. So I'll leave you now, and we'll go on to talk with Faye Stones. Okay, welcome back to the Roommates podcast. I haven't recorded one of these in a while, and I'm delighted that I'm joined by Faye today, who we're going to talk to all about spondylitis, pregnancy, how it's affected her through those particular journeys as well, and hopefully get some useful information and explore her experiences with regards to spondylitis and symptoms and how that's affected her, and certainly some challenges, I think, along the way as well. So welcome to the show, Faye. Thanks for joining me.
Hello.
Hiya. Do you want to quickly give us a bit of a background about yourself? Because there's a few interesting things about you which make you a great guest to talk to about some of these things.
Okay. Yeah. So my name's Faye. I'm a physio by profession. So I'm a head of MSK services and based in Wakefield, West Yorkshire. And I am a mum of two girls. 6 and nearly 2.
Perfect. And you have a couple of relevant diagnoses as well, don't you, for our audience? So do you want to tell us a little bit, not too much detail, but a little bit of background as to what happened to you, how you got those diagnoses, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a of an unusual journey to diagnosis, I think, than what you would, what you're typically told to look out for. So I was diagnosed when I was 23. And quite suddenly. So I, it's a bit of a, not a funny story about it. So I'd been on a hen do in Lincoln. And I remember driving back from that weekend and thinking, I've got this really, really severe pain. Anyway, this escalated over a number of days. And I was due to start a new job as an MSK physio. So my motivation behind seeking help and advice was this, was purely pain relief. Because I didn't want to be starting a new job, not being able to walk and being quite visibly in pain. So I went down to the GP practice and asked for some stronger anti-inflammatories. And it was down to kind of a really on the ball locum GP, which led to my diagnosis. So he obviously wasn't happy with my presentation. I'd not done anything. I hadn't fallen. I did tell him I'd been on a hen do and it was quite possible that I could have fallen and not being aware of it, but nothing significant. And obviously he quite rightly wasn't happy with the level of very acute, severe pain I was in such a short period of time. So he sent me for an MRI scan and gave me the anti-inflammatories quite usefully. Which I thought, okay, that's fine. I'll go down that and have that. I didn't really feel that I needed it. And then the results of the MRI came back with quite severe sacroiliitis, which led to them requesting a CT scan. They wanted to have a closer look. And obviously then the blood test followed for the HLA-B27, which came back positive. And so within a matter of a few weeks, I got from wanting some pain relief, I was then told I had ankylosing spondylitis, which I denied, said that they'd got it wrong. By that point, my symptoms had started to settle a little bit. And I think my focus was on just on starting a new job. And this was the kind of, I didn't really have time to be bothering with this. Things seemed to be starting to calm down. So I sort of said, That's really nice you think that, but I don't think I have. I think, you know, convinced myself I was one of those patients with the HLA-B27 positive, but didn't actually have the disease, ignoring the fact that my MRI scan just lit up like a like a light. So that was my diagnosis, really. So it was an unusual one. I wasn't somebody that was suffering in pain for a long time and desperately wanted to know the reason for this, and it was very quick, very sudden. So in terms of processing that whole diagnosis, if I'm honest, I think has taken me the best part of 10 years to do that.
Yeah, historically as well, so we go back sort of 10 years or so, that's when it was still deemed very much a male disease.
Yeah.
And interestingly, and I suppose in some ways luckily for you, you presented in a much more classical fashion by the sounds of it. We see a lot of women not presenting like that, very diffuse symptoms, very difficult sort of differential diagnosis. Mm. So it's, yeah, a really interesting journey from 10 years ago that actually, if we look at the data, women tend to wait a lot longer than men for diagnosis. Yeah. And you were the opposite end of the scale, happening very quickly. Do you think, just while we're talking about that, with the acceptance and the sort of understanding of the condition, do you feel like being a physio at the time was helpful or unhelpful at that stage? Because I often think a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
But tell me a little bit about that at the time.
I think it was, yeah, it's definitely been a hindrance, and I think it probably still is. So I think as physios, naturally, we work on the basis of cause and effect, don't we? And with something like ankylosing spondylitis, that doesn't really fit. So I think, you know, I think for years I was still struggling to find a cause for that and any differential diagnosis, you name it, I went through it, you know, what they've got it wrong, what could it possibly be? Or this has just triggered an acute inflammatory response here, and it's not actually a disease progression. And yeah, and I really and even now, probably sometimes when I'm not in a flare up, I'll think, oh yeah, I told you they got it wrong. So I'm very quick to defer back to I haven't got it. Than I have. So I think it, yeah, that acceptance and that denial probably was quite strong. I probably didn't want to accept because I, like you say, I knew too much.
Yeah.
So I think I was trying to shut myself away from that. The first rheumatologist I saw actually was a shocking experience. And I think you find this as a healthcare professional, whenever you seek any medical advice, is that there's a lot of assumptions made, perhaps about where you're at with something, your understanding of it, and all of that. And I think you're not necessarily treated the same way that somebody else would be. So I remember his words, you know, and he said to me, oh, you know, I didn't really fully understand it, wasn't accepting it. He said, don't worry, you have this disease, but you'll die of something else, was his his initial consultation with me. I thought, great. And I was, you know, I was having all the bloods taken, and they weren't really fully explaining the journey to me as perhaps they would have done with a patient. I think they just assumed, you know, you know these pathways, you're a physio. When I didn't have experience in rheumatology, that wasn't my area. So yeah, I think more could have perhaps been done there, definitely. And also because I wasn't looking for a diagnosis. I think a lot of our patients, they are, aren't they? They're looking for an answer. They're looking for an answer to their pain. And once they've got that, they almost feel a sense of relief. Whereas I was the opposite, that I was trying desperately not to have a diagnosis. And I think that even as professionals ourselves, we're not really prepared to manage patients that are coming from that angle.
There's a big sense of permanence about, especially something like ankylosing spondylitis or its related sort of subsets. It's like, you know, it's, oh, so something's gone wrong genetically, has it? Well, that's not improving, is it? And yeah, that bit of knowledge about that is, and then being told some of those things that you were then told, you know, you're not going to die of it. It's like, yeah, but it's going to be crap for years. It's not very helpful, is it? So that's really interesting. And I think, you know, I would hope nowadays that we're a bit better at explaining those things and gaining an understanding of what's going to happen. What was your, you said about anti-inflammatories, what was the process like with medications? Just, and where are you at now with medication?
Yes, obviously I was very anti-medication being a physio. I was, I think we make the worst patients, don't we, really? And, you know, I went down the classical route of courses of things like naproxens and celecoxib and that sort of stuff. And because of the way mine sort of presented, so I had that initial very strong flare up, very, very severe flare up. You know, I wasn't able to weight bear through my left leg at all. I remember trying to walk the dog with one crutch and the dog in one lead and tying a jumper around my waist really tightly because that seemed to help with that with the SI joint and doing all sorts of things. And because of the hypermobility side of it, medication's always been a tricky one because I don't fall into particular criteria for that. And I've not particularly wanted to. I've always tried to manage the flare-ups with the least medication as possible. I've recently had to have a course of steroids, which was so the first time since diagnosis I've needed steroids, and that was post COVID vaccination. Okay. I don't know how much you want me to talk about.
Let's come back to that. Yeah,
let's come back to that. I don't know how tricky that one is, but so yeah, that I suppose you would have classed me being in remission, so to speak, for a while, and that seemed to have thrown me out of one, and I've needed two courses of tapering steroids. So that's the strongest I've been. Okay. I've also had a guided steroid injection into the left sacroiliac joint, which was a horrendous experience, I'm not going to lie.
I can imagine, yeah.
That was, I don't think they've heard words like that come out of the CT scan before. But if I'm honest with myself, I think that probably did help. at that time. So that was after my first daughter, after having my first daughter, that was that sort of flare up required that injection. So now I don't take anything.
I
would always just revert to, if I'm in a flare up, it would be an approxin or celecoxib that I would take for a couple of weeks to get on top of things. But I very much try to, I know that it will improve.
Yeah.
So I tend to modify and I stick it out. Part of me thinks maybe I should be a little bit more keen on the anti-inflammatories, thinking about damage and things like that. But I try to stick it out, if I'm honest.
Mm. Really want to get into the conversation about obviously having your daughter and those kind of things. I just wanted to just take a step back, and you mentioned very briefly about the hypermobility as well.
Yeah.
Do you want to just tell us a little bit about how those two conditions are kind of interacting? So we've obviously got ankylosing spondylitis, which reduces mobility significantly, causes lots of stiffness. We've got hypermobility, which obviously theoretically is the opposite. How's that been, and has that caused you any particular sort of unique issues, do you think?
I think that the biggest thing to mention there is the fatigue, because obviously both of them are fatigue inducing, so the hypermobility definitely. It's a tricky one. I always try to explain it. So with the ankylosing spondylitis, that's trying to stiffen me up and the hypermobility is counteracting that. But so I have a good range of movement, but I have stiffness through movement.
Mm.
I am still classically hypermobile, but the feeling I get through that range is stiffness, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It can be painful, but I would present with full movement. When I see the rheumatologist, you would think, looking at me objectively, I'm absolutely fine. Until I describe how that feels, and then you look at my images, and then you look at the bloods, and you put the whole picture together. So I think it's been it's difficult. I don't know how it's hard, isn't it? I wonder how much the hypermobility helps me.
Mm.
I wonder what I would be like without the hypermobility. I've always wondered that, and vice versa. What would it be just with hypermobility and not with VAS? So
yeah. Yeah, certainly. If we think about the numbers of people who get ankylosing spondylitis and hypermobility, there is going to be an overlap. It's not like one protects you from the other. They're just different conditions. And I think I read recently of somewhere around 25% of people will fit a hypermobility criteria. So it's obviously highly common comparative to something like ankylosing spondylitis. There's definitely going to be some overlap. I was wondering about, you said about having retained your range of motion, but with the stiffness. I was wondering if there is any structural change, or if you know if there's any structural change. You talked about sacroiliac joints earlier. Have you seen any of that on x-ray as yet? You have?
Yeah. So the left SI joint is there was quite advanced erosion.
Okay.
On that left side. And that's, I'm actually waiting for another MRI, which will only be my second MRI, just to see if there is any active disease at the moment before I decide on another guided injection. So that would be the kind of route that I'm going down at the minute. But yeah, the left side has had quite a lot of damage, which is visible.
Yeah.
A little bit on the right side, but that's nothing else in the spine.
So again, unusual. You fit slightly into the more unusual category. Ladies don't tend to get the damage or the fusion the same as in the same numbers of men. And I wonder if, when you add all these pieces together, you're a very abrupt onset. You sort of had a more male onset of disease. You would fit more of a male category, which is interesting. And obviously these things aren't black and white. But again, it probably being female fits your sort of peaking and troughing presentation as well. So you've got a really interesting combination, and add the hypermobility on top of that as well. And then, like you say, all that fatigue. That sort of brings me on to talking about fatigue, brings me on to talking about children. If we, so you were obviously diagnosed prior to either of the, the daughters, weren't you? So do you want to tell what sort of happened? Give us a bit of an overview. You know, were there particular problems sort of with whilst you were pregnant, or was it mostly afterwards? Or tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Yeah, so by the time I was having my first daughter, the AS was probably quite dormant. I would say it wasn't causing me any real day-to-day issues. But when you obviously go through the checking of, you know, all your checks with your midwife and everything, you know, all my sort of medical records will pop up with all these things. And often when I go to appointments, and they ask you about your medical history, you know, and things like that, if it's not in a GP sort of land, I don't really tell them, because it's just nobody, you know, they don't really understand it. And then you've got to go into the whole thing. Well, actually, yes, but I'm not on any medication and it's all right. You don't need to worry about it. I just think I'll just save myself the time and not bother. But obviously going through the midwife's checks, going through, yes, you're under rheumatology and you've got this condition. And it was so bizarre. And she sort of looked at this list and she said, right, you know, your condition is on this list. It tells me that you need to take aspirin throughout your pregnancy. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Why is that? And she said, I don't know. It's just on the list. You need to take aspirin because you're at risk. You're at increased risk of preeclampsia.
Okay.
So being a physio, I went away and tried to have a look at any research between that. And it not very clear, to be honest. And nobody really could tell me why. Mm-hmm. It was just, you're on the list, so you need to take this. And so I thought, all right, okay. So I took this daily aspirin whilst I was pregnant. No problems in terms of pain or mobility. If anything, I would say, you know, those natural steroids kick in and I was probably feeling quite good. And then I continued with the steroids. And what happened with my first daughter was that I did develop preeclampsia, but on delivery. So again, I'm an unusual case in that I developed silent preeclampsia. So I didn't swell up. I didn't get any of the symptoms that you're told to look for. I felt a little bit unwell, but it was my first baby, so I didn't know what to expect until I was in labour and they hooked me up and found that I was quite severely ill. So I had quite a traumatic delivery with her. She was born in 20 minutes from start to finish. Which is what happens as part of preeclampsia. You know, the body has to deliver the baby and then things will calm down. So that was all a bit of a shock. And I think, again, going back to the whole acceptance and denial thing, because they'd not fully explained to me why I needed to take the aspirin and there wasn't any understanding, I didn't really see the importance of it. And I did take it, but obviously then I still went on to develop the preeclampsia they'd warned me about. But again, even after it happened, nobody could tell me the link between the two. So I suppose that a traumatic delivery with a significant amount of blood loss on top of having AS and hypermobility is not a good cocktail. So I was quite poorly for some time in terms of the fatigue. You know, I was quite severely anemic. And then I would say she was about 3 months when the flare up came. She was about 3 months old. And it was quite a bad one.
Yeah.
A significant flare up. So, and for somebody with a young baby to then have to deal with that was quite horrific. So just the practicalities of things, you know, waking in the night. I felt like I couldn't lift her out of the cot because I was struggling to weight bear again on that left side. It was very easily give way. I had that real sort of fierce, burning, intense pain in the pelvis. It was obviously in an active state of disease. But obviously you do those things because you're a mum. So I did go and pick her up in the middle of the night.
Can't leave her there. I'll just wait until my flare-up goes away. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I did have to carry her around up and down the stairs. You know, I did have to lug the car seats in and out and the prams, and I would walk leaning on the pram to try and take some of that pressure off a little bit. And I was always very much kind of conscious of hiding the fact I was in pain. And I perhaps always have been, even from day one. So that was a really difficult time, and that flare-up probably lasted the best part of 12 months as my body's trying to adjust from having a baby, for the traumatic birth, to losing all the blood, to then this inflammatory state having to die down again. So that was particularly difficult. And that's what led to me having a steroid injection in that left-hand side to try and calm things down again.
We see, I mean, that follows a lot of what we see in sort of the literature when you see ladies who have been through pregnancy, is they do tend to be better during the pregnancy and then they tend to flare afterwards. And there's some really obvious reasons for that with regards to your inflammatory system being elevated. And again, with yourself, clear, even increased more reasons for that to have occurred. We also do see it, mostly in with the Anki-Spond patients, is a lot of you weren't taking the medications that prohibited, but you know, a lot of the anti-TNF medications and the biologics you can't take while you're trying to conceive, and then you can't take while you're pregnant. So a lot of people, they won't flare, but their symptoms will be worse during pregnancy because they have to come off their medications. So in some ways you were sort of lucky, and then in other ways obviously clearly quite not. It's not something I have to admit I've heard much about, is the preeclampsia. There is a bit of a limitation in the amount of information we have about pregnant ladies with inflammatory spinal diseases, because as we mentioned already, we didn't know they existed so there's just not a lot of them for us to find that out. But you know, when you look at the data from sort of rheumatoid arthritis, where there's loads more, we see that pattern of symptoms, but you don't see a lot of birth complications, I have to admit. The ladies tend to have a slightly smaller baby, but otherwise they tend not to have any issues. So it's interesting to hear about the preeclampsia. It's something I'm going to go research, but obviously you didn't get very far. But
no, I didn't get very far, no. And literally it was a case of, it's on the list. On the list of reasons why you need to take aspirin. But nobody could go any further than that, really. Even the consultant, that obviously been having that condition, you become under consultant-led care for your, for that. And even they couldn't really shed much light on it. And they were also fascinated on the physical side of it, and on any issues around the pelvis in terms of the delivery, rather than they were the more systemic side of it, I think. And again, because I was appear very fit and well, I think there were less concerns. It took them all by surprise when that happened.
And again, it is more unusual for ladies for their sacroiliac joints to be damaged, for want of a better term. So I think you know, and obviously you need that mobility within the pelvis for the birthing period. So very, very interesting. And it doesn't sound like your sacroiliac joints are fused. So
no.
you probably wouldn't be able to read too much into that, but certainly very interesting. So you had that flare for an extended period of time afterwards, and required that steroid injection. Did that then settle you down?
Yeah, as I say, it wasn't a nice experience to have that done. But initially my thoughts was, oh my God, I'm never having that again. That was just horrific. But then when I've gone back and reflected on it and that period of time, I think it did, I do tend to respond very well to steroids. And I think that did settle things.
Okay. And then you decided you wanted another baby, did you?
Yeah.
I'll do that again. Why not?
Oh yeah, no. Originally it was absolutely not do that again. But so there is a bit of an age gap. So 6 and 2is enough time for you to forget what's happened.
And how was that second time around? I'm guessing you were more prepared for things that might go wrong potentially.
I think psychologically it was tough, if I'm honest. If you look at kind of the history of me, both things have. Everything's very unexpected and kind of come out of the blue, and there was no warning signs, equally with the diagnosis of AS and then with the preeclampsia. So I suppose my anxiety was quite high about at what point is it going to present itself again, at what point is it going to be any issue. So that was quite tricky to deal with, and I actually got some support with that from a counsellor, just because I didn't want to spend the whole pregnancy worried about what was going to happen. Which I think is understandable when I had none of the warning signs for anything. So I was under consultant care. I think the guidelines changed and the dose of aspirin was double what it was the first time round. But again, nobody could shed any light on as to why. It was more of a case of, this happened to you before, so let's make sure it didn't. So I had more checks. So I was in hospital sort of once a week for about 26 weeks, just double checking that I wasn't starting to show any signs of that preeclampsia. And then I opted for a C-section delivery with the second. And that was purely because the preeclampsia in with my first developed within the last week, very, very quick, a matter of days, really. And I didn't want to go to that last week and risk that again. So it wasn't about the actual delivery. It was more about the timings, if that makes sense, and yeah, having totally. A little bit of control over over that last little bit.
I can totally empathize with that to a degree with regards to not wanting to get into that last section. And then did you find you flared afterwards or...?
No. So, and I kind of say that tentatively, even though she's nearly two now.
Still waiting. Still
yeah, I'm waiting. I'm waiting. I'm like, no, I didn't. Which again is interesting as to why I didn't that time around. I wouldn't say perfectly fine. I think with AS, you're never perfectly fine. There's always an element of something there, but I definitely didn't experience that very severe flare that I did with the first.
Interesting. Okay. Certainly shows that, you know, some of these things aren't an inevitability, are they? And it's very variable depending on what sort of processes are. So if I'm gonna put you on the spot a little bit, I think if we had a whole host of ladies with AS who were or equivalents who were, let's say, early pregnant now or thinking of getting pregnant, what would you have any specific advice for them, do you think? Or would you try and reassure them? What would you say to them?
I think it is, I do think more, well, we can say this about a lot of things, can't we? But they do need to be more research in it and things and attainable information for patients about going through this, because you're under a rheumatologist who's looking after that side of you, and you're under a midwife who's looking after that, and there's no sort of there's no collaborative work in there in terms of you as a whole person, and I think we could say that for a lot of conditions, couldn't we? But so that does make it, there's a sense of the unknown and not really knowing where to turn to in terms of advice and support, and I suppose that's probably one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, because there must be other people in my situation. I'm not the only person going through this, and there is that sense of where do I turn to for help and guidance with this. So yeah, you know, there is reassurance that that people can, you know, we can go through this and have perfectly healthy, happy babies, and you can have a pregnancy which doesn't go to plan, and you can have one and that you don't tend to have a flare with. So it, like I say, it's not inevitable that you're going to have a bad experience, because I've kind of had two
very
with that.
Different. Yeah, yeah.
But I think my advice would be is to keep is to very much engage the rheumatologist and the consultants as much as possible about supporting you with what you do with medication, what you don't do with medication, and other aspects that you perhaps need a bit more support with. The patient almost has to be the one that joins up the two elements of care.
Yeah, we see, like you say, we see that in quite a lot of different departments, don't we? And I think asking questions, if it sounds, from my point of view, from externally, from what you've said, it sounds like you asked questions, you didn't really get enough of an answer back, and you still had questions to ask. And it's then, okay, where do I go to get the response that I need for that question, isn't it? Where's that next stage? If that person can't tell me what the answer is to enough of a degree to reassure me, then what do I do with that information? Did you go to NAS at all, the National Ankylosis Spondylitis Society?
Yes, I've been involved with them previously, and again I think they were also a bit of a loss, really, in terms of finding that support and evidence for those particular things. I don't know whether there's not a lot of other women coming forward with their experiences about this, or whether they just haven't got the platform to do that. I'm not sure. So it was very much it was either about managing the AS or it was about, you know, dealing with the risks associated, the complications with but with pregnancy. And with the rheumatologist, definitely it was a case of, well, have your baby and then we'll sort you out afterwards.
There isn't
that much of a journey that they go on with you. So I think my rheumatologist at the time said, you know, I'm here if you need steroids afterwards.
Right.
So it was a case of go and have that bit and then we'll pick up the pieces afterwards. Rather than supporting you through that.
And I think to a degree, you were on the simpler end as well, because you weren't taking anti-TNF medications at the time either. And it sort of, part of me is concerned that added complication would have made things even more difficult, especially the first pregnancy that you had. If you'd been stable on some medication and had to come off and then maybe go on to something else or mess around with the stability of the condition, that adds another level of complexity, doesn't it? I'm thinking I'm going to add this to my list of things to do, is to source a rheumatologist who can answer some of these questions for us. And maybe I'll get you back to come and fire questions at them from your point of view rather than me doing it. That's all really fascinating and amazing that you had such different experiences. And I know you sort of elected for the C-section, so some of those things that might have triggered that flare might have been avoided. And I was just going to ask, do you think you definitely made the right decision there? I'm guessing at the answer.
It wasn't something I'd do again. it wasn't an enjoyable time. But I think that just for that peace of mind that I wasn't going to go into that, you know, as your pregnancies go on anyway, I think anxiety for women just builds the further you go along. There's a lot of things to consider. So I think just by taking control of that one element that I could, it did help. Whether or not it helped, like you say, of an avoiding a flare, we don't know. I don't know whether that would have happened or not. But I think, I was definitely, there was an element of control there which helped.
Brilliant. This has been fascinating for me and given me lots of things to think about. Is there anything else you wanted to sort of get off your chest or let anybody know or any information you think might be useful to anybody before we wrap up?
I think, I suppose the only other thing to mention really is, I suppose more so for the female side, and maybe it is the hypermobility that would make somebody like me appear well. So a lot of what I get, if I mention to my staff that I have this, they don't believe it, because I don't know that they have the typical look of somebody with AS is, but I don't fit that sort of picture. I'm not there sort of complaining about my pain every 2 minutes, and and I suppose that, I would all, just for the professionals of your audience, really, I would ask them to consider what managing it well looks like, because are they actually managing it well, or are they hiding it well? What does it have to look like for you to say, or for you to empathise with somebody? I think just having an awareness of it does come in lots of different shapes and sizes, and the individuals will manage that condition in many different ways, whether they're in sort of, they've really taken control of that condition and they're very proactive and their self-management is really good. Are they more on the denial aspect of it, and actually, you know, they are sat there and their pelvis is burning away at them, but they're choosing not to tell you that, and they choose to, you know, and I suppose if you were to look at me to the untrained eye, you know, my gait would look fairly normal, my movement would look normal, so I think it's just having that, consider what managing it well kind of looks like, and perhaps before making that assumption and using those phrases is to delve a little bit deeper into that.
And you've been very honest with us that you have hidden it at times and put a brave face on it and carried on regardless. And I wonder, you said, I just wanted to pick up very quickly on something you said a little while ago about should have been taking anti-inflammatories a bit more, a bit earlier, or a bit, being a bit braver taking them, or being less brave and not putting up with it so much to take the anti-inflammatories. If you, it's very difficult to give advice, I suppose, on an individual basis, but is that something you've changed your approach on? Would you now take the anti-inflammatories a bit earlier, or are you still stubborn?
There's still a stubborn element. doesn't help with the fact that I'm now an independent prescriber as well. So my knowledge on the effects of anti-inflammatories and steroids is, too much knowledge is dangerous, I think, as a patient. Mm. And I do go, you know, to the rheumatology nurse with some very difficult questions about medication, such as I'm very aware of the long-term use of steroids, particularly in women. So I'm trying to balance it between having that knowledge and protecting my other body systems, if you like, from some things, but also not completely just avoiding taking that. So I suppose I am a little bit quicker to do something to calm it down. Mm. Because I do have that history of knowing what a very severe flare feels like, and I don't want to go back there again. But I will definitely not stay on them for a minute longer than I need to be. And I suppose not everybody's going to have that approach to things. It's a difficult one.
That's very similar to the advice I tend to give to people. I often say, if you imagine that your inflammatory system is doing this, you need far less medication to intervene here than you do up here. And then coming off the other side. So I often say to people, you know, it's better to take it early and then realize you didn't need it for a few doses than it is to wait for a few weeks and then realize, now I need a steroid injection, or I need 6 weeks or whatever it is. Equally, it's got to be what works for the individual.
And I think that, you know, I've been, when we talk about the, you know, the classic symptoms of waking in the second half of the night with pain and in my experience, you know, it's horrific pain, if I'm honest. It's a very, very fierce burning. You know, I've been sat at 2 o'clock in the morning with an ice pack on my SI joint and it's melting within minutes because there's that much active inflammation. Mm. Not getting to that stage is important. Sometimes it isn't avoidable in my case. I do seem to have a very fast acting, get these very abrupt flares rather than the slow burning sort of flare ups. Mm. So, you know, I do try and do other things apart from just reach for the tablet straight away, but I think years gained has told me not to leave it too long.
Yeah, and it is hard because, as you mentioned, we know there are anti-inflammatories are no good for you, steroids are no good for you, but the flare-ups are no good for you either, and there's got to be a butter zone somewhere, and that's going to sit different places for different individuals. And some people will be, I've met all of the types, as you can imagine. As soon as they get a twinge of anything, they're straight into the anti-inflammatories. And other people, a bit more like yourself, they're like, no, I'm going to, this might settle down in 10 days. Yeah. I don't need them. I'll stick it out for 10 days and carry on. But it's what people can deal with. I mean, your consultant to a degree was right. You know, the flare up isn't going to kill you, but it isn't going to be very nice. And it's, you know, I say to people a lot, if you can't do the things you enjoy, that's going to have a very big impact upon you. And if you can carry on doing the things you can enjoy, then you can tolerate quite a lot of symptoms. But as soon as you start to not do those things, then those symptoms become a lot more impactful on your life. And I think it's trying to find that balance, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've definitely adapted, you know, over the years when I was sort of, again, going through all the differential diagnoses I could possibly think of. For having this is, I'll be, you know, going back to that cause and effect, I think, right, you know, if I get in the gym, I do some strength and conditioning, this is going to fix me. This is, you know, this is what I need to do, because it would in the short term make me feel better. And I think, yeah, see, you know, I was right. I haven't got this. It's completely, you know, it's just, I've got weakness. And again, going that if I strengthen it, it will get better. And then a flare would hit and would just, you know, it's almost like it was trying to prove me wrong all the time. So I've adapted, you know, I've given up, not that I was sort of a super keen runner or anything, but that was somebody that was able to go out for a run. That's just, you know, that's off the cards. The impact on the SI joint is, you know, that's just not possible. But I do still enjoy, you know, other things. I've got a horse and I ride and I walk, and I've done things like yoga in the past, which has been, you know, massively beneficial. So I have very, very slowly adapted, like you say, to be in a position that I can do things even if I do have symptoms.
Yeah.
But that was a journey I had to go on to get to that. There was a lot of kind of throwing my running trainers and saying, I'm never going to be able to do this, and you know, going to the gym and then walking out because I was in too much pain. And yeah, I battled it a long time, I think, to try and get control of it, which was difficult. But yeah, I've given up on those. I'm becoming a little bit more accepting.
It's only taken a decade.
Yeah, it's only taken a decade of that. But it is, you know, and you can have, you know, you have days where you think, oh, I feel great. There's absolutely nothing wrong with me. And then it can be something as, you know, if I just tend to catch that SI joint in the right position, often if I'm changing direction quickly, and obviously that erosion and that damage is there, that it will just remind me, you know, that, oh, remember there's that there. And then instantly mentally your brain does go to a bit of a negative place and you think, oh yeah, you're just reminding me something's there. But day to day, I would say I don't let it control my life. Mm. It isn't at the forefront of
good
of what I'm doing.
Excellent. Well, brilliant. I'm delighted you've spent the best part of 45 minutes or so chatting with me. It's been really fascinating. I've got loads of things that I'm going to follow up on as well and try and find some more info. Thank you very much, and hopefully some people find this useful from your experiences, and I hope that anybody will get in touch with me on social media if they want to have questions, and I'll try and follow up some of the unanswered things we've done today. Mm. We've got two today. I'm going to put those on my list.